ghetto. The train had travelled 44 miles from Łódź to Koło. Then everyone was taken to another train, this one running on a narrow-gauge track to Powiercie. By the time they arrived, it was late in the day, and they spent the night a few kilometers away in an abandoned mill. It was there that Hersch met my mother. She said that she had a daughter about the same age he was, and she worried about me. She hoped that there would be a way to get word back to the ghetto. She asked Hersch if he had family there, too. She reminded me of my mother, Hersch said. My parents both went with the second roundup. I thought that maybe we were being taken to the same place to work, that I would get to see them again. We were sitting down now, with Basha and my father, who were hanging on every word Hersch spoke. After all, if he was here, didn't that mean my mother might soon follow? Go on, my father urged. Hersch picked at a scab on his hand. His lips were trembling. The next morning, we were divided into small groups by the soldiers. Your mother went with one group into a truck, and I went with another that held 10 young men, all tall and strong. We drove up to a big stone mansion. We were brought to the basement of the manor house. There were signatures all over the walls, and one sentence written in Yiddish, "He who comes here does not walk away alive." There was a window, too, nailed shut with boards. Hersch swallowed hard. I could hear through it, though. Another truck pulled up, and this time one of the Germans told the people who had been transported that they were to be sent east to work. All they had to do was take a shower first and put on clean clothes that were disinfected. The people in the truck, they started clapping their hands, and then a little while later we heard bare feet shuffling by the basement window. "So, she is all right," my father breathed. Hersch looked down at his lap. The next morning I was taken to work in the woods with the others who had spent the night in the basement. As I left, I noticed a big van parked up against the house. The door of the van was open, and there was a ramp to get inside. There was a wooden grate on the floor, like the kind you might see in a community bathhouse, he said. But we didn't get into this van. Instead, we went in a truck that had tarpaulin on its sides. About 30 SS men came with us. There was a huge pit that had been dug. I was given a shovel and told to make it bigger. Just after 8 in the morning, the first van arrived. It looked like the one I had seen at the manor. Some of the Germans opened the doors and then ran quickly away from it, while grey smoke poured out. After about 5 minutes, the soldiers directed 3 of us inside. I was one of them. He sucked in his breath as if it were coming through a straw. The people inside, they had died from the gas. Some were still holding each other. They were wearing their underwear, but nothing else. And their skin was still warm. Some were still alive. And when that was the case, one of the SS men would shoot them. After the bodies were taken out, they were searched for gold and jewelry and money. Then they were buried in the pit, and the towels and bars of soap they had been given for their shower were gathered to be brought back to the manor house for the next transport. As I stared at Hersch, my jaw dropped. This made no sense. Why would you go to so much trouble to kill people? People who had been manufacturing items needed for the war effort. And then I began to do the arithmetic. Hersch was here. My mother was not. Hersch had seen the bodies being unloaded from the vans. "You're lying," I spat. "I wish I were," he whispered. "Your mother, she was on the third truck of the day." My father put his head down on the table and started to weep. Six of the boys who had been picked to work in the woods were killed that day, shot because they weren't doing their job fast enough. I survived, but didn't want to. I was going to hang myself that night in the basement. Then I remembered that even if I didn't have family left, your mother did, and that maybe I could find you. The next day on the transport to the woods, I asked for a cigarette. The SS man gave me one, and suddenly everyone in the truck was asking for a smoke. While he was being swarmed, I took a pen from my pocket and used it to poke a hole in the tarpaulin and tear a long rip. Then I jumped out of the truck. They started shooting, but didn't hit me. And I managed to run through the woods until I found a barn, where I hid underneath the hay in the loft. I stayed there for 2 days, and then sneaked out and came back here. I listened to Hersch's story, although I wanted to tell him he was a fool trying to break into the ghetto when all of us wanted to get out. But then again, if getting out meant dying in a van full of gas, maybe Hersch was the smart one. There was a part of me that still could not believe what he said and continued to dismiss it. But my father, he immediately covered the only mirror in the house. He sat on the floor instead of in a chair. He tore his shirt. Basha and I followed his example, mourning our mother the way our religion told us to. That night, when I heard my father crying, I sat down on the edge of the mattress he had shared with my mother. We, who had been so crowded in this apartment, now had more room than we needed. "Minka," my father said, his voice so soft I may have imagined it, "at my funeral, make sure. He broke off, unable to tell me what he wanted me to remember. Overnight, his hair went snow white. Had I not seen it with my own eyes, I would not have believed it possible. It is probably the hardest thing to understand, how even horror can become commonplace. I used to have to imagine how you might look at an upyur sucking the blood from the neck of a freshly killed human and not have to turn away. Now I knew, from personal experience. You could see an old woman shot in the head, and sigh because her blood spattered onto your coat. You could hear a barrage of gunfire and not even blink. You could stop expecting the most awful thing to happen because it already had. Or so I thought. The first day of September, military trucks pulled up to the hospitals in the ghetto, and the patients were dragged out by SS soldiers. Daria told me that at the children's hospital, people reported seeing babies tossed from the windows. I think that was when I realized Hersch could not have been lying. These men and women hobbling in their hospital gowns, some too weak or too old to stand on their own, could not have been going to work in the East. The next afternoon, the chairman gave a speech. I stood with my sister in the square, bouncing Meyer between the two of us. He had another cough and was fussy. My father, who had become a shadow of his former self, was at home. He dragged himself to the bakery and back, but he did not go out in public otherwise. In a way, my little nephew could take better care of himself than my father could. Chairman Rumkowski's voice crackled over the loudspeakers that had been erected at the corners of the square. "A severe blow has befallen the ghetto," he said. "They are asking for the best it possesses, children and old people. I have not had the privilege to have a child of my own, and therefore I devoted the best of my years to children. I lived and breathed together with the children. I never imagined that my own hands would have to deliver the sacrifice to the altar. In my old age, I must stretch out my hands and beg. Brothers and sisters, give them to me. Fathers and mothers, give me your children." There were gasps and shrieks, shouts from the crowd around us. Mael was in my arms at that point. I pulled him tighter against me, but Basha ripped him from my grasp and buried her face in his hair. Red hair, like Reuben's. The chairman went on to talk about how 20,000 people had to be deported, how the sick and the elderly would only tally 13,000. Beside me, someone shouted, "We'll all go!" Another woman cried out her suggestion that no parents lose an only child, that those with children to spare be the ones to give them up.
"No," Basha whispered, her eyes full of tears. "I won't let him be taken."
She hugged Meyer so close that he started to cry. The chairman was saying now that this was the only way to appease the Germans, that he understood the horror of his request, that he had convinced the Germans to take only children who were under 10 years old because they would not know what was happening to them. Basha leaned over and vomited on the ground. Then she pushed through the crowd, away from the chairman's podium, still holding Meyer. "I understand what it means to tear a limb from the body," Rumkowski was saying, trying to plead his case. "So did I. It meant that you bled out." At the end of the workday, Herr Fassbinder did not let us leave the factory, not even to go home and tell our parents we would be staying late. He told the officers who demanded an explanation that he had emergency deadlines and was requiring all of us to sew through the night. He barricaded the doors, and he stood at the entrance with a gun I had never seen him carry before. I think that if a soldier had come to take away the little ones he employed, he would have fought his own country. This was, I knew, for our own protection. A curfew had been imposed, keeping everyone in their homes, as the SS and the police searched house by house to select the children who would be deported. When we started hearing shots and screams, Herr Fassbinder told everyone to remain quiet. The young mothers, on the knife edge of hysteria, rocked their children. Herr Fassbinder handed out candy for them to suck on and let them play with empty spools, stacking them like blocks. By the next morning, I was frantic. I couldn't bear thinking of Basha and Meyer, wondering who would protect them, with my father still an empty shell. "Herr Fassbinder," I begged, "please let me go home. I am 18, too old to be considered a child."
"You are meine Kleine," Herr Fassbinder replied.
I did something incredibly bold then. I touched his hand,
As nice as Herr Fassbinder had been to me, I never allowed myself to think that I was his equal. If I go home tomorrow, or the next day, and find that someone else has been taken away from me while I was gone, I don't think I'll be able to live with myself. He looked at me for a long moment, and then directed me to the door. Walking outside the factory with me, he flagged a young German policeman. "This girl must get to her apartment safely," he said. "This is a priority, and I will hold you responsible if it does not happen. Do you understand?" The policeman could not have been much older than I was. He nodded, terrified by Herr Fassbinder's promise of retribution. He walked briskly with me to my apartment, stopping when we reached the front steps of the building. I thanked him under my breath in German and flew inside. The lights were off, but I knew that wouldn't stop the German soldiers from coming inside and looking for Meyer. My father was on his feet the moment he heard me enter. He folded me into his arms, stroking my hair.
"Minusha," he said, "I thought you were lost to me."
"Where's Basha?" I asked. And he led me to the pantry, the one whose flooring my poor cousin Rivke had ripped up over 2 years ago. A small mat made of newspapers was covering the hole that revealed the crawl space beneath. I pulled it aside and saw the gleam of Basha's eyes looking up at me in panic. I heard the soft pop of Maya's thumb in his mouth.
"Good," I said.
"This is very good. Let's make it better." Searching frantically around the apartment, I laid eyes on the barrel that my father had brought home from the bakery. Once full of flour, it now served as our kitchen table, since we had burned the original one for fuel. I hauled it onto its side and rolled it into the pantry, then balanced it over the hole in the floor. It would not look strange to keep a flour barrel in the pantry, and it was one more obstacle to any soldier realizing there was a hidey hole beneath it. We knew they were getting closer because we could hear people in apartments nearby, both those who were taken from their families and those who were left behind, screaming. It was another 3 hours, though, before they came into our home. Slamming the door back on its hinges and demanding to know where Meyer was. "I don't know," my father said. "My daughter hasn't been home since the curfew started." One of the SS men turned to me. "Tell us the truth."
"My father is telling the truth," I said.
Then I heard it. The cough and a tiny wail. Immediately, I covered my mouth with my hand. "You are ill?" the soldier asked. I couldn't say yes, because that qualified me as one of the sick to be transported. "Just a sip of water that went down the wrong pipe," I said, beating my chest with my fist to prove a point until the noise disappeared. The soldiers ignored me after that. They began to open cabinets and drawers, places small enough to hide a child. They ripped their bayonets into the straw mattresses we slept on, in case Meyer was tucked inside. They looked inside the belly of the wood stove. When they reached the pantry, I stood very still, while the soldier swept his gun along the shelves, tumbling our meager rations to the floor and into the empty barrel. He looked down into its gaping mouth. The SS man turned around and stared at me without emotion. "If we find her hiding with the child, we will kill her," he said. And he kicked the barrel. It did not tip over. It didn't wobble. It just shifted the tiniest bit to the right, pulling the newspaper along with it, and revealing the tiniest black crack along the edge that was a hint of the gaping hole it covered. I held my breath, certain he would see this,
But the soldier was already calling the others to move on to the next apartment. My father and I watched the SS men leave.
"Not yet," my father whispered when I made a move toward the pantry.
He pointed furtively to the window, from which we could still see our neighbors being dragged onto the street, marched away, shot. After 10 minutes, when the soldiers had left the street and the only sounds were the wails of other mothers, my father ran to the kitchen and pulled the barrel aside.
"Basha," I cried, "it's over."
She was sobbing and smiling through her tears. She sat up, still clutching Maya, as my father helped her out of the narrow space.
"I thought they would hear the coughing," I said, hugging her tightly.
"I thought so too," Basha confessed. "But he was such a good boy. Weren't you my little man?"
We both looked down, to where Meyer's face was pressed tightly against his mother's neck, the only way she had been able to quiet him. Meyer wasn't coughing anymore. He wasn't screaming. But my sister, looking down at her son's blue lips and empty eyes, was. The children were driven in wagons through the ghetto gate. Some of them were dressed in their fanciest clothing, whatever was left of it at this point. They were crying at the tops of their lungs, calling for their mothers. These mothers were expected to go to their factories to work, as if nothing out of the ordinary had happened. The ghetto was a ghost town. We were a beaten, gray stream of workers who did not want to remember our past and did not think we had a future. There was no laughter, no hopscotch remaining, no hair ribbons or giggles, no color or beauty left behind. Which is why, they said, her death was so lovely. Like a bird, she flew from the bridge across Lutomierska Street into the road where Jews were not allowed. They said Basha's unbound hair fluttered behind her, like wings, and her skirts became the fan of a tail. They said that the bullets, as they hit her in midair, gave her bright crimson plumage, like a phoenix that was meant to rise again.
In the dark, there was a soft growl, almost a purr, the rasp of a match, a scent of sulfur. The torch blazed to life again. Crouched before me in a pool of blood was a man with wild eyes and knotted hair. More blood dripped from his mouth and covered his hands, which held a haunch of meat. I fell back, struggling to find air. This was the cave in the side of the cliff where Alex had told me he made his modest home. I had come here hoping to find him after he escaped from the village square. But this was not Alex. The man, could I even call him such, took a step closer. That haunch of meat he was devouring had a hand, fingers. They were still clutching the top of a gilded cane I couldn't have forgotten if I tried. Baruch Beiler was no longer missing. I felt my vision fading, my head spinning. "It wasn't a wild animal," I forced out. "It was you." The cannibal smiled, his teeth slick and stained crimson. "Wild animal. Upure. Why split hairs?" "You killed Baruch Beiler." "Hypocrite. Can you honestly say you didn't wish him dead?" I considered all the times the man had come to the cottage, demanding tax money we didn't have, extorting deals from my father that only dragged us deeper and deeper into debt. I looked at this beast and suddenly felt like I was going to be sick. "My father," I whispered. "You killed him, too?" When the Upur didn't answer, I flew at him, using my nails and my fury as weapons. I raked at his flesh and kicked and swung. Either I would avenge my father's death or I would die trying. Suddenly I felt an arm around my waist, yanking me backward. "Stop!" Alexander cried, his full weight pinning me to the ground. From this angle, I could see the chains that encircled the Upur's bare, filthy feet, the pile of bleached bones beside him. I could see, too, the ragged cuffs of Alexander's shirt, drenched with blood. Whatever he'd done to free himself from the ropes Damien had trapped him in, it must have been painful. "Leave me alone!" I shouted. I didn't want Alex to save me, not this time, not if it meant I couldn't avenge my father's death. "Stop," Alex begged, and I realized I wasn't the only one he was trying to protect. "Please, he's my brother." I stopped fighting. This was Casimir? The feeble-minded boy Alex had to stay with during the day and lock up at night so that he wouldn't eat what he shouldn't? True, I had never seen his face without the leather mask, and Alex had said he consumed things like stones and twigs and dirt, not humans. If that had been a lie, how could I trust anything Alex had told me? I shook my head, trying to understand. Alex had protected me. He had saved my life when I was hurt, by his own brother. And yet, he had the same unearthly amber eyes as this creature beside me. He had the same blood beating through his veins. "He is your brother," I repeated, my voice breaking. "But I no longer have a father." I tore away from Alex and faced Casimir. "Because you killed him. Say it." I was shaking so hard I could barely stand upright. But Casimir wouldn't speak, wouldn't give me the satisfaction. I began to run blindly in the direction from which I'd come, striking against sharp corners, tripping over rocks and ruts in the cavern floor, landing hard on my hands and knees. As I struggled to my feet, Alexander's arms closed around me. I stiffened, remembering that indirectly he was the cause of all my pain. "You could have stopped him," I sobbed. "He murdered the only person who ever loved me."
"Your father is not the only person to ever love you," Alex confessed. "And you cannot blame Casimir for his death."
He turned away so that his face was in shadow.
"Because I am the one who killed him."
Minka. For a while, people disappeared from the ghetto like fingerprints on a pane of glass, ghosting into vision one moment and the next gone, as if they'd never been there. Death walked next to me as I trudged down the street, whispered into my ear as I washed my face, embraced me as I shivered in bed. Herr Fassbinder was no longer my boss. Instead of working in an office, I was reassigned to a factory that made leather boots. My hands shook even when I wasn't sewing. That's how hard it was to force the needle through the tough hides. We lived expecting to be deported at any minute. Some ladies in the factory had the diamonds from their wedding rings implanted as fillings by the dentist. Others smuggled small pouches of coins in their vaginas and came to work this way in case the roundups happened there. And still, we went on living. We worked, and we ate, and we celebrated birthdays, and gossiped, and read, and wrote, and prayed, and we woke up each morning to do it all over again. One day, in July 1944, when I went to collect Daria to stand in line for rations, she was gone. I hardly had time to grieve, though. By then it was almost expected to lose the people who meant the most to you. And besides, 3 days later, my father and I found ourselves on the list for deportation. It was hot, The kind of heat that made it impossible to believe that months ago we could not get warm, no matter how hard we tried. The fabrique had been blistering, windows closed, the air so thick it felt like a sponge in your throat. Walking outside for the first time in 12 hours, I was grateful for the fresh air, and in no great hurry to go home, where my father and I would sit up the whole night, wondering what would happen the next morning, when we were to assemble in the town square. Instead, I found myself picking a convoluted path through the narrow streets and twisted alleys of the ghetto. I knew Aaron lived somewhere around here, but I had not seen him in several weeks. It was possible that he, like Daria, had already been deported. I stopped a man on the street and asked if he knew Aaron, but the man just shook his head and moved on. I was doing the unthinkable. We didn't talk of those who had been taken from us. It was like those cultures who don't name the dead for fear that they will haunt us forever. Aaron, I asked an old woman, Aaron Sendik, have you seen him? She looked at me. I realized with a shock that she was not much older than I was, but her hair was white and there were bare patches on her scalp. Her skin draped from her bones like fabric too heavy for its hanger. He lives there, she said, and she pointed to a door further down the street. Aaron answered the door with terror on his face. And why wouldn't he? When we heard a knock, it usually was followed by a soldier barging in. Upon seeing me, though, his features softened. Minka. He reached out his hand to me to pull me inside. It was like an oven in there. Is anyone here? He shook his head. He was wearing an undershirt and trousers, which had been pinned to keep from falling off his skinny hips. His shoulders were slick with sweat, shiny, like the knobs of a brass flagpole. I reached up on my tiptoes and kissed him. He tasted of cigarettes, and the hair at the nape of his neck was damp. I pressed my body along the length of his and kissed him even harder, as if I had been dreaming of this moment for years. I suppose I had been, too, just not with Aaron. Eventually Aaron must have realized he was not hallucinating, because his arms caught me around the waist, and he started to kiss me back, tentatively at first, and then wildly, like a starving man given access to a banquet. I stepped away from him, and, looking him straight in the eye, unbuttoned my blouse, let it hang open. I was nothing to look at. My ribs were more prominent than my breasts. There were circles under my eyes that never went away. My hair was dull and tangled, but it was still long, at least. It took me a moment to recognize the look in Aaron's eyes. Pity. Minka, what are you doing? He whispered. Suddenly embarrassed, I pulled the edges of my blouse together to cover myself. I was too ugly even to get this boy, who had once been interested in me, to take the bait. If you can't figure that out, I'm doing a very bad job, I said. I'm sorry I disturbed you. I turned my back, hurrying to the door as I fastened my buttons, but was stopped by Aaron's hand on my arm. Don't go, he said quietly. Please. When he kissed me again, I thought that if I'd had the time, and maybe a different life, I could have fallen in love with him after all. He laid me down on the mat where he slept, which was in the center of the one-room apartment. There was no need to ask, why now? Why him? I didn't want to give the answer, and he wouldn't have wanted to hear it. Instead, he just sat down beside me and held my hand. "You're sure about this?" Aaron asked. When I nodded, he peeled the clothes from my body and let the sweat dry on my skin. Then he pulled off his undershirt and shucked off his pants and covered me. It hurt when he moved between my legs, when he pushed inside of me. I didn't understand what all the fuss was about, why the poets wrote sonnets about this moment, why Penelope had waited for Odysseus, why knights rode off to battle with ribbons from their lovers wrapped around the hilts of their swords. And then I understood. My heart, batting like a moth under my ribcage, slowed to match the beat of his. I could sense the blood in his veins moving with mine, like the inevitable chorus of a song. I was different with him, transformed from ugly duckling to snowy swan. I was, for a minute, the girl of someone's dreams. I was a reason to stay alive. Afterward, when I was dressed again, Aaron insisted on walking me back home, as if he were a real boyfriend. We stopped outside my apartment. My father was in there, I knew, packing for our deportation in the single suitcase each of us was allowed. He would wonder where I'd been. Aaron leaned down, right there in public, with neighbors passing on the street, and kissed me. He seemed so happy that I thought I owed him a grain of truth. I wanted to know what it was like, I whispered. Because this may be my last chance, I thought. And I looked up at him. Thank you very much. Aaron laughed. That seems a little formal. He bowed, an exaggeration of manners. Miss Levin, may I call for you tomorrow? If I had any love for him, I owed him more than that grain of truth. I owed him the comfort of a lie. I curtsied and forced a smile, as if I would be here tomorrow to be courted. Of course, kind sir, I said. That was the last time we ever spoke. If you had to pack your whole life into a suitcase, not just the practical things like clothing, but the memories of the people you had lost and the girl you had once been, what would you take? The last photograph you had of your mother? A birthday gift from your best friend? A bookmark embroidered by her? A ticket stub from the traveling circus that had come through town 2 years ago, where you and your father held your breath as jeweled ladies flew through the air and a brave man stuck his head in the mouth of a lion? Would you take them to make wherever you were going feel like home? Or because you needed to remember where you had come from? In the end, I took all of these things, and the copy of The Diary of a Lost Girl, and Meyer's baby shoes, and Basha's wedding veil. And, of course, my writing. It filled 4 notebooks now. I tucked 3 of them inside my case and carried the other in a satchel. Into my boots, I wedged my Christian papers beside the gold coins. My father was silent as he held the door to the apartment that was not ours open for the last time. It was summertime, but we were wearing our heavy coats. This is how you know that even then, even in spite of the rumors we had heard, we were still hopeful. Or stupid. Because we continued to imagine a future. We were not put into wagons. Maybe there were too many of us. It seemed like hundreds. As we marched, soldiers rode alongside on horseback, their guns glinting in the sunlight. My father moved slowly. He had never gone back to being himself after my mother was taken. And losing Mayer and Basha left its mark as well. He could not follow a whole conversation without his eyes going distant. His muscles had atrophied. He shuffled instead of striding from place to place. It was as if he had been bleached of color by some chronic, harsh exposure. And although you could discern the outline of the man he'd been, he was no more substantial than a ghost. The soldiers wanted us to walk at a steady clip, and I worried that my father would not make it. I was weak and dehydrated, and the road we were traveling on seemed to ripple before my eyes. But I was stronger than my father. "The train station isn't too far," I urged him. "You can make it, Papa." I reached over and took his suitcase in my free hand so that he wouldn't have to carry the weight. When the girl in front of me tripped and fell, I stopped. My father stopped, too. It caused a swell, like a tide butting up against a dam.
"Was ist los?"
the soldier closest to us asked. He kicked at the girl who was lying on her side. Then he bent down and picked up a stick from the side of the road. He poked her and told her to get up. When she didn't, he took the stick and tangled it into her hair. He tugged, then harder. He yelled at her to get up, and when she didn't, he started to twist until she began to scream and her scalp tore like a hem. Another soldier approached, leveled his pistol, and shot the girl in the head. It was suddenly quiet again. I started to cry. I couldn't catch my breath. This girl, whose name I did not know, her brains were on my boot. I had seen dozens of people shot in front of me, to the point where it was hardly shocking anymore. The ones who were shot in the chest, they dropped like stones, cleanly. The ones who were shot in the head left behind a mess, runnels of gray matter and foamy pink tissue, and now it was on my boot, caught in the treads, and I wondered what part of her mind that was. The power of language? Of movement? The memory of her first kiss? Or her favorite pet? Or the day she moved to the ghetto? I felt my father's hand close around my arm with a strength I did not realize he still possessed.
"Minusha," he whispered, "look at me."
He waited until I was staring into his eyes, until my panicked breathing slowed.
"If you die, it will be with a bullet to the heart, not the head. I promise."
It was, I realized, a macabre version of the game we had once played, planning for his death. Except this time, he was planning for mine. My father did not speak again until we had boarded the trains. Our suitcases had been taken elsewhere, and we were packed into the freight cars like cattle. My father sat down and put his arm around me, the way he had done when I was little.
"You and I," he said softly, "will have another bakery where we're going, and people will come from miles around to eat the bread we bake. And every day I'll bake you your own roll, with the cinnamon and chocolate inside, the way you like. Oh, it will smell like heaven when it comes out of the oven."
I realized that the car had gone quiet, that everyone was listening to my father's fantasies.
"They can take away my home," he said, and my money, and my wife, and my child. They can take away my livelihood, and my food, and, here his voice hitched, my grandson. But they can't take away my dreams.
His words were a net, drawing everyone into a chorus of agreement.
I dream, said the man across the rail car, of doing to them what they've done to us.
There was a smack on the wooden wall of the railway car, startling us.
Us. Them.
But not all Jews were victims. Look at Chairman Rumkowski, who sat safe with his new wife in his cushy home, making lists, with the blood of my family on his hands. And not all Germans were murderers. Look at Herr Fassbinder, who had saved so many children on the night the children were taken away. Another sharp rap on the car, this right behind where my head rested on the splintered wood.
Get out, a voice whispered through the narrow slats from the outside. Escape, if you can. Your train is going to Auschwitz.
It was chaos. The ramp where we disembarked was a sea of humanity. We were numb, stiff, suffocating from the heat, gasping for fresh air. Everyone was screaming, attempting to locate family members, trying to be heard over the soldiers who were stationed every few feet with guns pointed at us, and who yelled for the men to go to one side and the women to go to the other. In the distance was a long line of people who had arrived before us. I could see a brick building with chimneys. Several men in striped clothing were trying to sort us. They looked like the pods of a milkweed, plants that might have once had color and animation, but that now had dried up and were waiting to blow away on a breath. They told us in Polish to leave our belongings on the ramp. I grabbed the sleeve of one man. Is this a factory? I asked, pointing toward the building with the smokestacks.
Yes, he said, his lips pulling away from his yellow teeth. It's a factory where they kill people.
In that instant, I remembered the boy who had told me what happened to my mother, how I had thought he was lying or crazy. My father began to move to the left with the other men. Papa! I screamed, running toward him. As the butt of a gun crashed down on my temple, I saw stars. Everything went white. And when I blinked again, my father was moving further down the men's line of the ramp. I was, to my surprise, being dragged forward by a woman who had worked with me at Herr Fassbinder's embroidery fabrik. I turned around and craned my neck just in time to see my father standing in front of the soldier at the head of the line, who stood with his finger on his pursed lips, assessing each man as he stepped forward.
Links, he would mutter. Rechts.
I saw my father heading to the left, moving with the longer line of people.
Where are they taking him?
I asked wildly. But no one answered my question. I was pushed and shuffled and yanked forward until I stood in front of one of the guards. He was standing beside a man in a white coat, who was the one directing us. The soldier was tall and had blonde hair. He was holding a pistol. I looked away, trying to find my father in the moving mass of people. The man in the white coat grasped my chin in his hand, and it was all I could do not to spit at him. He looked at the bruise already forming on my head and murmured, "Links," then gestured to the left.
I was euphoric. I was headed in the same direction as my father, which meant surely we would be reunited. Danke, I murmured out of habit. But the soldier, the blonde one, had heard what I said under my breath.
Sprichst du Deutsch? He asked.
Ja, fließend, I stammered. I am fluent. The soldier leaned toward the man in the white coat and murmured something.
White coat shrugged.
Rechts, he pronounced. And I panicked. My father had been sent to the left, and now I was being sent to the right, because I had been stupid enough to speak German. Maybe I had offended them. Maybe I was not supposed to talk back, much less in their native tongue. But I was clearly in the minority. Other women, including the one who had worked with me at Herr Fassbinder's, were being sent to the left. I started to shake my head, to protest, to beg to go left. But one of the Polish men in the stripes pushed me to the right. I have thought about it many times, you know, about what would have happened if I had gone to the left, which every muscle in my body was pulling me toward. But nobody likes a story without a happy ending, and I knew that I had to do whatever they said if I were to have any chance of seeing my father again. As I passed the soldier who had spoken to me, I realized his right hand, the one that was holding his pistol, was twitching, almost like a tremor. I was afraid he'd shoot me by accident, if not on purpose. So I hurried by him and stood with a smaller group of women until another soldier marched us to a red brick building shaped like the letter I. Across the road, I could see people milling in a grove, sitting quietly in front of the big building with the smokestacks. I wondered if my father was with them, if he could see me standing here. We were herded into the building and told to undress. Everything off. Clothes, shoes, stockings, underwear, hairpins. I looked around, embarrassed to see strangers naked in front of me, and even more embarrassed when I realized that the male soldiers who were guarding us did not plan to leave us in privacy. But they did not even look at our bodies. They seemed indifferent. I moved slowly, as if I were peeling off layers of skin and not just fabric. With one hand, I tried to cover myself. The other held on to my boots, like my father had told me. One of the guards walked up to me. His eyes slid over me like a frost, settling on my boots. "These are fine boots," he said, and I tightened my arms around them. He reached down and plucked them from my grasp, giving me a pair of wooden clogs instead. "Too fine for you," he pronounced. With those boots went any chance I had of bribing my way out of here or getting information about my father. With those boots went the Christian papers that Josek had gotten me. We were moved to a table where Jewish women in striped clothing held electric razors. As I got closer, I saw how they were shaving women's heads. Some got away with short hair. Others were not as lucky. I was not a vain girl. I had not grown up pretty. I was always in the shadow of Daria or even Basha. Until we moved to the ghetto, I had baby fat, a round face, thighs that rubbed when I walked. Starving had made me skinny, but it hadn't made me any prettier. The only saving grace I had was my hair. Yes, it was dull and matted now, but it was also every color of brown, from chestnut to mahogany to teak. It had a natural wave and a curl at the end, even when I braided it in a rope down my back. That plait was thick as a fist. Please, I said, don't cut off my hair.
Maybe you have something to persuade me to give you just a trim.
She leaned closer. You look like the kind of person who would smuggle something through. I thought of my boots in that German soldier's hands. I thought of this woman who had presumably once been in line like us. If these Germans wanted to turn us into animals, then by all accounts they had succeeded. Even if I did, I whispered back, you'd be the last person on earth I'd ever give it to. She looked at me, raised her razor, and buzzed my hair off at the scalp. It was at that moment I realized I wasn't Minka anymore. I was some other creature, something inhuman. Shivering, sobbing, I followed orders and hurried blindly into the shower room. All I could think of was my mother and the false bathhouse that the boy had told me about, those trucks full of gas that were emptied of bodies in the woods. I stared up at the shower heads, wondering if they would spray water or poison, wondering if I was the only person who had heard these rumors and whose heart was threatening to burst from her chest. Then, a hiss. I closed my eyes and tried to picture all the people I had loved in my short life. My parents, Basha, Daria, Rubin and Meyer, Josek, Herr Bauer, even Aaron. I wanted to die with their names on my tongue. I felt a trickle. Water. It was cold and sporadic. The shower heads turned on and off before I managed to turn in a full circle. No gas, no gas, I thought, a litany. Maybe that boy had been wrong. Maybe what happened here was not the same as what had happened in Chełmno. Maybe this was what the soldiers had told us, a work camp. There it was again. That mewling cry of hope. Raus! A guard yelled. Dripping, I shuffled quickly out of the shower room and was given clothing. A work dress, a head covering, a jacket with blue and gray stripes. No socks or underwear. I dressed fast. I wanted to cover up the shame of being naked, indistinguishable from the other women around me. I was still buttoning my jacket when a guard grabbed me and dragged me toward a table. There, a man rubbed alcohol on my left forearm, and another man began to write on me. I didn't understand what he was doing at first. It burned, and I could smell the sear of flesh. I looked down. A14660. I had been branded. Like cattle. I had no name anymore. We were pushed into a hut with no light, and as my eyes adjusted, I could see bunks 3 tiers high, with straw laid on each tier as if this were a stable. There were no windows. The building reeked, and packed inside were several hundred women. I thought of the rail car, how he had been stuffed inside and had gone for days without seeing the sun or stopping to stretch or go to the bathroom. I did not want to go through all that hell again just to die. Better now, I thought. And before I realized what I was doing, my feet were turning away from the entrance to the hut, and I was running with all the strength I could muster, flying across the dirt as best I could in my wooden shoes toward the electric fence. I knew, if I got close enough, that I would be free, that Aaron and Daria and, please God, my father would remember me as Minka, not as this bald animal, not as a number. My arms stretched outward as if I were racing toward a lover. A woman's voice started to yell. I could hear the angry shouts of a guard, who a moment later collided with me, shoving me down on the ground and landing with his full weight on top of me. He dragged me upright by the collar of my dress and threw me into the barracks so that I landed sprawled on my face on the concrete floor. The door was slammed shut. I pushed myself to my knees, only to find someone reaching out a hand to me. "What were you thinking?" a girl said. "You would have died, Minka!" I squinted. One moment I could not see past the low light and the shorn head and the bruises on her face, and then the next, I recognized Daria. Just like that, I became human again. She had been here 2 days longer than I had, and knew the routine. The Aufseherin oversaw the women's blocks. She reported to the Schutzhaftlagerführer, the male commandant of the women's camp. On her first day, Daria had seen him beat to death a woman who stumbled out of her straight line during roll call. Inside the huts were the Stubenältesten and the Blockältesten, who were Jews in charge of the individual rooms of the barrack and the entire barracks, respectively, and who were worse sometimes than the German guards. Our Blockälteste was a Hungarian called Borbalo, who reminded me of a giant squid. She stayed in a separate room in the hut, and had a chin that ran right into the fleshy sleeve of her neck, and eyes that glinted like chips of coal. Her voice was as deep as a man's, and she would scream at us in the morning at 4 to rise. It was Daria who told me to sleep with my shoes on, lest another prisoner steal them, and to tuck my bowl inside my shirt as I slept for the same reason. She explained the Bettenbau, the military bed we were expected to fashion out of the straw mattress and the thin blanket. It was, of course, impossible to make straw look as precise as a real mattress. This was just an excuse for Borbalo to make someone an example for the rest of us. Daria was the one who told me to run to the toilets, because there were only a limited number for hundreds of us, and we had only a few moments before roll call. Being late was, once again, grounds for a beating. Daria touched her head as she told me this, her temple still blooming with a mottled purple bruise. She had learned the hard way. At Appel, we were counted, sometimes for hours. We were to stand at attention, as Borbalo called our numbers. If someone was missing, everything stopped while that person was located, usually sick or dead in the hut. She would be dragged into position and the count would start over again. We were forced to do sport, running in place for hours at a time, then dropping to the ground when Borbalo commanded us to do frog leaps. Only after that were rations given. Dark water that passed for coffee, a slice of brown bread. "Save half," Daria told me that first day, and I thought she was joking. But she wasn't. It was the only solid food we got. There would be a watery broth with rotten vegetables for lunch, maybe a broth with rancid meat for supper. It was better, Daria assured me, to go to bed on a full stomach. Sometimes there were exercises, even though there wasn't enough food to keep us strong. Sometimes we had to learn German songs and phrases, including basic commands. All of this was done in the shadow of that long, low building I had seen when we first got off the train, the place with the smokestacks that burned day and night. From those who had been in quarantine longer than we had, we learned that they were crematoria, that Jews had built them, that the only way out of this hellhole was as ash through those chimneys. 5 days after I arrived, and after we had finished the morning appel, Borbalo ordered us all to strip naked. We stood in a line in the courtyard, while the man in the white coat I remembered from the ramp paraded by us. With him was the same SS soldier whose hand shook. I wondered if he would recognize me, try to speak in German. He did not even flick his glance over me, however. And why would he have recognized me? I was just another skinny, shaved prisoner. I knew better than to speak or to move, especially with an SS man present. If we made Borbalo look bad, we would pay for it later. The man in the white coat picked 8 girls, who were immediately taken from the hut and sent to Block 10, the medical facility. Anyone else who had a scrape or a cut or a burn or a blister was weeded out as well. His eyes passed over Daria and then settled on my face. I felt the touch of his stare, sliding from my forehead to my chin, to my breastbone. My teeth started to chatter, in spite of the heat. He flicked his glance past me, and I heard Daria exhale heavily through her nostrils. After an hour, those of us who remained were told to dress and to get our bowls. We would be moved out of quarantine, Borbalo told us, after we had our morning meal. A girl named Ilonka volunteered to carry the giant pot of coffee because with the task came an extra bread ration. Look at that, I murmured to Daria as we stood in line with our bowls. The pot is bigger than she is. It was true. Ilonka was a tiny thing. But there she was, carrying the giant steel tub as if it were filled with manna from heaven instead of swill. She set it down gently, so not a single drop sloshed over the edge. Borbalo, however, was not as careful. When it came to my turn, nearly half of the coffee spilled onto the ground. I looked at the puddle the couple had made, which was just enough time for her to notice the disappointment on my face. "So sorry," she said, in a way that let me know she was not sorry at all, and she held out my slice of bread. Except instead of handing it to me, she dropped it into the mud puddle made by my coffee. I fell to my knees to grab the bread, because even mucked in dirt it was better than losing an entire ration for the day. But before my fingers could close around it, a boot crushed down on the slice, pushing it deeper into the mud, and hesitating long enough for me to understand the action was deliberate. I squinted into the sunlight and saw the black silhouette of a German soldier. I rocked back on my heels, waiting for him to pass. When he did, I grabbed the bread from the mud and tried to press it against my dress, to get rid of the worst of the filth. I could not see the soldier's face anymore, but I knew who it was. As he walked away from me, his right hand was still twitching. Daria and I shared a bunk with 5 other women. The hut where we lived was no different from quarantine, except there were more of us, about 400 crammed into the block. The smells were indescribable. Unwashed bodies, sweat, festering sores, rotting teeth, and always in the air around us, the sweet, charred, sickly scent of flesh burning. What was new, though, was the condition of these other women. Some had been here for months, and they were no more than skeletons, their skin drawn over their cheekbones and ribs and hips, their eyes sunken and dark. At night, the sleeping quarters were so tight that I could feel the hip bones of the women behind me pushed like twin daggers into the small of my back. When one of us rolled over in our sleep, the rest of us had to do the same. I had spent the week trying to get word of my father. Was he in a different part of the camp, working like I was? Was he wondering if I was alive, too? It was Agnat, a woman who shared the bunk with us, who bluntly told me my father was gone. That he had been gassed that very first day. "What do you think is the business of this camp?" she chided. "Death." Agnat had been here for a month, and had a mouth on her. She would talk back to the Blokälteste, a woman we called the Beast, and get beaten with a truncheon. She would spit at a guard and get whipped, but she had also fought off a prisoner who tried to steal my jacket in the middle of the night when I was sleeping fitfully. For this small loyalty, I was grateful to her. 2 days ago, there had been an inspection in the hut. We had lined up while the capo tossed aside the neat covers we had made on our beds and pulled the bunks away from the wall to see what was being hidden. I knew that prisoners had items stashed. I had seen women with a deck of cards, money, cigarettes. I had seen one girl, too sick to eat her midday soup, carefully hide it underneath the straw that made up her mattress so that she could save it for later, even though having any food in the barracks was a serious infraction. When the guard came to our bunk, he began pulling aside the covers and found, to my surprise, a book by Maria Dombrowska. "What is this?" he smacked one of our bunkmates, a girl who was only 15, across the face. Her cheeks started to bleed.